reveal to how prison narratives are constructed, and an opportunity to hear writers actually talking about their researching their stories. And Isabel, I think, is going to start off. Again, I've asked the speakers to introduce themselves. So we're going to start with Isabel, and then we're going to hear from Adam, and then from Rod is going to start the question.
So, hello. It's been fascinating so far. An awful lot of what I was going to say has now been said, but anyway. So I'm Isabel Gray. For 20 years I wrote mainly crime dramas for television. And I now write crime fiction. So I started out on the Bill, where there was very close connections with police. So I've always had very good first-hand research sources, and I've always tried to sort of keep that going. And long before I ever started writing, even thinking about writing crime, I was for 10 years a volunteer with a prison charity called the New Bridge, which befriends prisoners, and I was on their management committee and very involved with it. So I have been as a visitor inside quite a lot of different prisons. I have written about the experience of visiting a prisoner in one novel, but I thought I would just take one particular piece of work that I did as a sort of case study for you as how I research it. So there are two aspects to research. One is actually coming up with the story in the first place. You know, what is it that sort of goes ping, oh, that's an idea, I'd like to write that, and I'll start to explore what it is. And the other is, once I've got that, is how I flesh that out. And stories rarely develop in isolation. It is about who the story is for, where I can sell it, basically. So I'm going to explain the process that led to a story that was eventually commissioned, although it didn't start out that way, as an episode of a BBC series called Accused. This went out in 2012. It was the second series of Accused, which is Jimmy McGovern created and co-writes all the episodes, although they are kind of original episodes by incoming writers. So it was called Tina's Story, and it was the final episode in the second series. So it ended up being the final episode of Accused. Both series won numerous BAFTAs and international Emmys. Extremely well received. So the structure of Accused, any episode of Accused, is that you start with someone being taken from the cells beneath the court up into the dock, and then the rest of the hour is what they did to get there. So you don't know what crime they've committed, you don't know anything about it, you just know that they're in the dock for something. So my episode starred Anna Maxwell-Martin and Ewan Bremner, from Trainspotting, as prison officers. And Anna Maxwell-Martin's character was in the dock. It does make a difference who the commission is for. So once I knew that Jimmy McGovern wanted this story and was very keen on it, I originally pitched it as an episode of his earlier series, The Street, and he said it didn't work for The Street, but he just loved the story, and he said, trust me, I'll be back to you. And about 3 years later, I get a phone call out of the blue saying, told you! and we did it for Accused. We had no editorial, because it's Jimmy McGovern, we had no editorial interference from the BBC at all. They didn't even read the scripts until Jimmy had signed off on them and they were ready for production. I think a lot of crime dramas now, something like Line of Duty, are very aware that you've got to sell it in America. In order to get the funding for a long series, you've almost certainly got to get an American sale. And I think that does influence the kind of content and the kind of attitudes towards crime, and particularly punishment. So, I've always been interested in institutions, and in particular about what institutions do to the people who work in them. all my family, apart from me, are medical. I sort of grew up hanging out around hospitals and clinics and so on. And I was very aware of the kind of, you know, the magic of the white coat and the stethoscope on my parents and on people's attitudes to my parents and then to my brothers. So I was visiting, when I was a prison visitor with the Newbridge, I had one prisoner who was first in Long Larton and then in Whitemoor, and I visited over very many years. They're quite geographically isolated, and on the sort of drive there and the drive back, I would often think about the communities around the prison, you know, what it would be like as a prison officer to live in one of these quite small isolated communities, and what would happen if somebody else from the community was in jail. And I was also very struck by the demeanour of the prison officers, what a difficult and strange job it is. And I was interested to write about that. So that's where the idea came from, and I then started to kind of think about prisons and institutions, and around that time there was a lot in the papers about prison suicides, particularly of juvenile offenders. And I thought, you know, what kind of effect does that have on an officer? So I started to do my research. There was a parliamentary debate at the time, which was reported in Hansard, and a private member's bill from an MP called Hilton Dawson. So I arranged to go and speak to him. And bearing in mind, this is pre-2012, he had been a social worker, and he told me that he had gone into politics because he thought that he would have more influence and could get more done. And because of the Daily Mail effect, no one in Parliament would support his private member's bill. Everybody was running, every MP was running scared of the Daily Mail at that time. Nobody wanted to support him at all. So he, in fact, was standing down and did stand down at the next election and went back to social work because he felt he could do more good. I then also came across a quote. Now, I haven't read the book, so it could be that this has been quoted out of context or whatever, but I came across a quote that the then Home Secretary, David Blunkett, had written in his diaries, and as I say, I haven't read them, that on hearing that a prisoner had committed suicide, he felt like pouring himself a drink. We're talking about children. Most of these suicides are children. They're homesick. They're frightened. They're bored. They don't know what they've done. An awful lot of these suicides could have been prevented with bigger budgets and better staffing. So how do you write a drama that is essentially about staffing levels? You know, it's not exactly dramatic. But that's what I wanted to do the impossible. So that's what I was setting out to do. So the second part of writing is the hunt for the detail that will make any drama alive and real and convincing. So I'm going to digress and tell a little tiny story. My brother is now retired, but was a Home Office pathologist, a forensic pathologist. And he very kindly read a chapter of one of my crime novels, talking me through the crime scene, spent about 2 hours, you know, in very patiently giving me every single detail about what would happen inside a forensic tent at the scene of a crime. And then at the end, and I took notes and everything, and at the end he said, but there's one thing in the, as I've already written it, you've got to change. The pathologist cannot drive a Volvo. You've got to give him a Porsche. Now, I know, obviously, enough about my brother's working life to know that he spent hours and hours. He drove thousands of miles. Half of those miles on the way to a crime scene, and half of them on the way back from a crime scene. Some of these were sort of long decayed bodies in woodland, some were in water, some were the most chaotic, dreadful domestic things. You know, a car became, you know, he had to, you know, had a dictaphone in the car, so on the sort of several hundred mile journey back, he would be dictating his notes about the crime scene. And making sure that he had to get them right. And so, you know, quite often at that time they were very understaffed. He would get home only to find that there was another call out and he had to sort of go off, herring off sort of to another side of the country. So, you know, it's not frivolous that he might want a Porsche. He never did have a Porsche, and indeed when he retired he bought a Volvo. But anyway. But is that knowledge about what the job is like that tells you the truth about a job and a world and an environment? So for me it's always, you know, kind of what's the humour? What are the jokes? What cars do they drive? What's important to them? You know, what are their values outside the work? You know, what is the normality of an environment that for most of us is not normal? Prisons were a very, very difficult world to access, even though I'd been in and out many times, many prisons, as a visitor. The POA at the time was, locked in negotiations with, whether it was then the Justice Department or the Home Office, I don't remember, but, you know, things were difficult. But it was impossible. I found it impossible to get any prison officer to talk to me. And finally, through a retired police officer friend, she got someone to talk to me completely off the record on the phone. And even when I explained, you know, I'm talking about staff shortages and funding and your working conditions. You know, I need to hear it from you. It was still very, very difficult to actually get first-hand accounts of that. And I think, from what I observed as a visitor, that, you know, openness and careless talk are not part of the job description. So it may just be a kind of ingrained habit that prison officers just, you know, don't chat a lot in that sort of way. What I was very aware of in depicting prison life is that there are very, very, very strong stereotypes. And how do you counter those? How do you actually paint a picture of prison life that isn't, you know, like, was it Roger earlier talking about the screen in Line of Duty? You know, I've never seen one of those either. So it's trying to, you know, everybody thinks you're wrong if you just have people sitting at a table, because they've seen this screen in every single drama, so that they know this, they know it about prisoners, that that's how it is, and it's not in England. So it's trying to get past that kind of fake news element and make people think fresh about what a prison environment might be. And I came across a phrase, behind the door, which for me just said it all. You know, what is the reality for a teenager who's never been in a prison before, of being behind the door, of having that door shut, and you're on your own. And I knew from my visiting that the huge extent of mental health problems within prisons, and I had grown up, I had an aunt who was a long-term mental patient, so I'd spent a lot of my life visiting mental hospitals over my entire lifetime, and I think at that time, you know, she had died by then. But anyway, you know, I know it's bad enough having a mental health problem in a hospital, but to have one in a prison. how do you write about, how do you dramatise homesickness and frightening, you know, just the kind of din of a young offender's institution, the claustrophobia of it, the frustration, the bureaucracy, the hanging about, the sort of not getting answers to things, trying to make sense of the internal hierarchies and the unruliness of it all. So what I'm looking for in my research is those tiny little details and what would just bring that to life. So backstory is important. Again, you know, trying to understand where my characters have come from. And again, I know from my my brother's work how easy it is for somebody to be killed, and that most crime is chaotic, probably to do with drink and drugs, particularly drink. He said most of his bread and butter work, you know, was alcohol fueled, but it's chaotic, and that a lot of the people involved are kind of inadequate in some way. You know, they might have, you know, come out of care, be illiterate, and as I say, have mental health problems. So if it's some chaotic scuffle outside a club when you're drunk, and it's landed you in prison with a long, possibly a life sentence, being behind the door, if you're young, must be absolutely petrifying. So it's trying to show that. So we showed the journey to the prison. You know, we show these doors banging, the keys, the locks, the corridors, which, you know, I know for most young offenders institutions aren't like that. They're quite soft. You know, there's a lot of wood, there's carpet or paint or whatever, carpet tiles. And so, you know, I know we were playing to a stereotype in the type of building that we portrayed, but it was also the only way in which to bring home another type of authenticity, which is about the noise and the fear. At the end of the day, you've got to dramatise your story. And my story was about a prison officer who won't toe the line and does speak out about the suicide, which she discovered is due to staff shortages. And because she is speaking out against the wishes of her colleagues, that she is sent to Coventry and that she feels at risk. She feels the same fear within this prison environment as the young prisoner. So how do you end a story like that? The prisoner who's come in has now committed suicide. We actually spent about 5 hours, the script editor, producer, Jimmy and me, trying to work, you know, what is the correct end to our story and how can we make it as real and, you know, believable as possible? And in the end, you know, what Jimmy wanted was just to have her open the prison doors and have everybody run out. We couldn't quite manage that, but we got as near as we could. So it's got to, you know, you've got to be true, but you've also got, you know, my job is to write a damn good story, which will be powerful and make people think about prisons. And it might be that not every detail is accurate in order to do that. But it's got to be truthful. You know, it can be inaccurate, but truthful, one hopes. And there were things that, in order to have the suicide, I checked with my brother exactly how the kid would do it. And he did explain it all to me. And he said, you shouldn't show it. Because it's actually really, really easy. You're not hanging yourself. You're actually sort of suffocating yourself with the method. And he said, I don't want that on primetime television to tell everybody how easy it is to kill yourself. So, you know, I will explain to you the method of death, but, you know, please don't show it. And there are things that, you know, like that maybe one shouldn't show. 2 points to finish. One is that casting is absolutely crucial. I mean, I think the fact that we had Anna Maxwell Martin to play the prison officer meant that immediately, you know, the whole audience was on her side. And the fact that we had Robert Sheehan to play the juvenile offender, who had in fact also had his own story in the previous episode, which took him to prison. But it can also backfire, because when he committed suicide, I was following on Twitter, and all his fans switched off immediately. So we lost quite, you know, probably about 500,000 audience figures. The whole series, but particularly, I have to say, there's a point to this, not just self-praise. The episode got amazing reviews, amazing write-ups, heaped with praise, couldn't have asked for more. Did it start any kind of debate about prisons? No. No. And that, that's the question. How do you start a debate? I don't know. I wrote a drama about staff shortages in a prison. Did it start a debate? No. Won BAFTAs. Won Emmys. No debate. Okay. Thank you.
Very interesting. Yeah. My name is Adam Handy. I'm the author of a series of books called the Pendulum Trilogy. I'm also a screenwriter. I'm the co-founder of Capital Crime, which is a crime writing festival that's in London in September. I probably come to this from a very different perspective than most of the people here. I grew up surrounded by criminals. My mother was in the hospital bed of my oldest, next to the mother of my oldest friend. And I won't name him because we're still friends and this is being recorded, but his father was a convicted armed robber. And I didn't know this at the time, but when I would go around to play at his house and got to know his sort of friends and extended family, it was London's villains. And somebody who I can talk about because he's dead was somebody that I knew as Uncle Jimmy, was a man called Jimmy Nash, who had in the late 60s gone into a pub and shot three people, two of whom died, and the third person survived, and he was tried for murder and attempted murder. And the famous superstar villains, although I don't agree in sort of celebrating crime in this way, but the craze put pressure on the survivor, and he actually ended up testifying as a character witness for the defense. And Uncle Jimmy Nash, served, I believe he served 5 years in the end. And I grew up going around to his house, and I knew nothing of this, actually, until I bumped into Martina Cole, who's familiar with this whole set. And I said to her, "Oh, do you know Jimmy Nash?" And she said, "Oh, yes, lovely man." And I went and had a look at what this lovely man had done. And this was only a couple of years ago, and I thought, "My goodness." But I knew that a lot of the people around my friend's dads were villains, but this was, you know, proper villainy. And so I grew up knowing that criminals are human beings, which may sound odd, but we've kind of been talking about criminals as the other, separate from society, that they could actually be any one of us. There may be people sitting in here who have criminal records, who've had run-ins with the police for whatever reason. They are not the other, they are us. And for me, the research that I do is always about trying to get to the truth of a situation, the truth of a character. And I always imagine myself having taken that path. What could have led me to be in that situation? And I think that's a big part of what's missing from the debate on this issue, and it's what we talked about earlier as the Daily Mail effect. It's that lack of empathy, that it could be any one of us. And it makes us feel safe and secure to alienate these people and to other them, because we feel like, oh, that could never be me. That could never happen to me. And I'm glad they're getting the strongest and most stern punishment ever, because I'm not like that. And the truth is, had a few things gone a different way, any one of the Daily Mail readers sitting there with that paper could have been that person that's ended up in prison having that punishment. What's really interesting for me about this whole debate today is that I actually think that sometimes you don't see a true representation of the prison system in the media because people wouldn't believe it. So I'll give you a very specific example. In my first book, Pendulum, the main character ends up in Rikers prison, jail actually, in New York. And it's a jail, so people are there on remand, they're awaiting trial. And I made reference to the fact that there was my character's cellmate had been on remand for 2 years. And I was at a book group with an American lady who was the ACLU trustee for New York, and who had a specific role in looking at what was happening at Rikers. And she said, "Oh no, this would never happen." And the beauty of Google is that you can just produce. And I was able to show her that the average time spent on remand at Rikers is 179 days. Innocent people spend on average, or guilty, but people who have not been found guilty spend 6 months on average in Rikers. What actually got me into putting my character into Rikers was the story which some people, maybe many people in this room would be familiar with, was the story of Kalief Browder, who was a 16-year-old who was arrested on the testimony of one person, the alleged victim of a robbery, who pointed Kalief out to police 2 weeks after the alleged robbery was supposed to have taken place. Khalif was supposed to have stolen a backpack from this person, and he was arrested and ended up being sent to Rikers at the age of 16. Rikers has 10 cell blocks, 8 for men or young adolescent males, 1 for females, and 1 that is in such a terrible state of disrepair that it is now permanently closed. The blocks, when he first arrived, he was sharing a cell with 15 other young adolescent males, and the conditions were such that he had to hand wash his own uniform. The American penal system, as a writer, is very interesting because it is very much the Old Testament view of crime and punishment. They looked to us, I was talking to Kate, a criminologist, earlier on, saying that the Americans look to us and Europe as a progressive criminal justice system. And so you have this 16-year-old boy who protests his innocence throughout the period that he's in custody. And thanks to a series of delays and mistakes by his lawyer and by the prosecution, Khalif spent 3 years in Rikers. And he attempted suicide a number of times. And even though he was offered a time-served plea deal by the prosecution, he refused because he said, "I'm innocent. I did not do this." And unfortunately, when he was finally released, as a result of the witness having returned to Mexico and the prosecutors being unable to locate him, not because he was found innocent or because the prosecution declined to proceed, Khalif took his own life. He was unable to cope with what had happened to him because the final 17 months in Rikers, he spent in pretty much non-stop solitary confinement. Partly because it was the easiest way for him to be safe. He would deliberately get himself sent to solitary because he was being victimized by gangs that wouldn't, because he wouldn't join them. He wouldn't, you know, sort of kowtow to their hierarchy. And it subsequently came out that prison officers at Rikers, Department of Corrections officers, were using the gangs to enforce rules. They were basically using them to enforce discipline. And what's fascinating about this whole thing is that a lot of this is on video. There's such a culture of othering the inmates, and the guards suffer, the officers suffer from, dehumanization to a certain extent, that, you know, there's video of Khalif being brutalized by a Department of Corrections officer outside his cell. And the officer doesn't seem to care that there's video recording of this. There was another incident that the ACLU, the lady who was part of the ACLU, took issue with, is I have my character attacked by 20 other inmates in Rikers. And she says, oh, that would never happen. They would put the block into lockdown and that just couldn't happen the way that you've written it. And I actually wrote it almost shot for shot based on an attack that happened to Khalif. 20 prisoners attacked him in a sustained attack that lasted, I think, about 8 minutes, and guards were there unable to do anything. So sometimes you'll put things into works of fiction that are absolutely a reflection of fact, and they are not believed because truth, as I'm sure everybody who's had any experience of the criminal justice system will know, is often much, much more strange than fiction. So I come to everything looking for that kernel of truth and that kernel of authenticity, but sometimes it's too much. You have to pull it back. So I think the other source of information that I rely on, obviously, I rely on things like reports from the Inspectorate of Prisons. I'll read. I wanted to know what it's really bizarre. I wanted to know what the holding cell was like at Cardiff Airport, and the Inspectorate of Prisons had actually done a report and found Cardiff Airport's facilities to be wanting. It's basically where you would put somebody who's come in on an unofficially or has some questions about their immigration status. And interestingly, it had only been used twice in the preceding 18 months. So Cardiff is not a hotbed of immigration issues. But where it had been used, people had been held in there for extended periods of time because they were not able to, the airport was not able to get hold of the private contractor that then had to take them from the airport to whatever holding centre they needed to be removed to. So there's a tremendous wealth of information out there. I think I read a report recently, a prison report recently, it was about 180 pages long. I mean, they're very detailed. They go into a lot of detail about the conditions inside prisons. It's a wealth of information. You've obviously got news reports. And the other thing that I do, and it brings me back to what I started with, is I talk to criminals, people who've been convicted and served time, and they are surprisingly willing to talk. I was researching a TV show recently set around the world of VAT carousel frauds, and was talking to people who were at the time actively engaged in the illegal activity, and they're willing to talk, provided you don't name them or allude to whatever they're up to. Criminals are very, very accessible, and if you have ever heard Misha Glennie talk, the journalist who wrote McMafia, he has exactly the same experience. He'll go and talk to some of the most dangerous villains in the world, and after a bit of time, when you build up a rapport and trust, you can find out incredible amounts of information, and that's interesting to see it from their perspective, because obviously you have people like Khalif who are traumatized by the experience, and then you have people like Uncle Jimmy who just viewed it as part of his job. It was a hazard of what he was doing. That was, you know, fair dues. I've gone and done my time, and it was part of their profession, if you like. So, you know, there's a real mixed bag of perceptions out there amongst the sort of criminal community.
Thank you very much.
Right, well, thank you, Isabel, thank you, Adam. My name's Rod Earl, I'm from the Open University. I think I'm here to sort of field some questions and hopefully to introduce some questions from the audience and a bit of audience participation and to get the sort of conversation flowing. But just by way of introduction to myself, I suppose, I think my relationship to prison is a bit like my relationship to meat, in that I'm a vegetarian. And some of that, I think, derives from sort of spending a bit of time being sent to prison 40 years ago. I did sort of barely 3 months in prison. And then sort of another 20-odd years later, I find myself working as trying to become a criminologist. And keeping the two sort of stories apart, particularly when I was conducting research in a prison, became sort of difficult and somehow sort of fraudulent. So I sort of stumbled across this idea that there's something in America called convict criminology, which is sort of a criminology of convicts, people who've been in prison, trying to combine elements of that personal experience with their conventional criminology, in a sense. But there's all, I think it sort of resonated with me, some of this idea about a narrative, because if you've been convicted, you have been given a very powerful narrative. That conviction will stay with you, and you have to sort of create another story that can counter that. So there's an idea within convict criminology of a sort of counter narrative. How can you tell another story that will somehow or other cancel or work around that narrative? So I think convict criminologists are sort of in the business of narrative, and it's partly, again, how can you tell certain sort of stories of prison? And to me, this meeting of minds is really interesting, because we're almost in such different places. Somebody this morning said, you know, I have to make a living out of this. If my book doesn't sell, I don't eat, as it were. And when I published my book, I was absolutely thrilled that Policy Press had taken it on and published it. And then my son looked it up and said, "Wow, Dad, it's 60 quid. And he thought it must be a really good book. Like good food, it costs, doesn't it? And I haven't disabused him of that. I'll let him read it when he's ready for it. But it does seem to me that we're in very different kinds of business. I would be very hungry if I relied on my book to feed me. And I think that's one of the differences, because more and more now we are driven to write by certain kinds of impulses, academics. So, what do we write for? Who do we write to? Who reads our stuff? Well, other academics, perhaps, or something else. We always aspire, in a sense, maybe to have that bestseller. I don't think many criminologists, will find their book, at the airport, waiting to be picked up. But almost we wish it was. So there's a certain degree of that. But also a lot of the writers have talked about truth. They want to find a truth. And I think sometimes as academics or criminologists, we come with questions. I don't think we're necessarily in the same way sort of seeking to represent a truth or to create a truth. And prison is so powerful because it is such a travesty, as it were. That's, I think, my experience, just 3 months in Norwich was revealed to me so much which was false about what I thought about prison. I met people I made friends with. I was never going to stay friends with them. There were some scary people. There were some not that different to being at school. Again, the sense you've got to avoid some people, other people you might. It was kind of ordinary. And as I said, I think it's just really boring. I lost a lot of weight, the food's horrible, you don't get enough exercise, all the norms, as it were. So there's and criminologists struggle with this idea of the media representation. And, one of the people I came across in researching my book, Convict Criminology, was a guy called Frank Tannenbaum, who did about a year in prison as a young man as well. But he sort of came to the idea of labelling theory and said, what you must do is refuse to dramatise the evil. But that's what you, as writers, do. So, I feel some ways we're in different parts of the block, as it were.
That's interesting, because I don't actually... When I write, I try not to actually present the villains as evil, because I think every villain is a hero of their own story. That's that famous phrase. It comes back to what I was saying earlier. I think that the path to villainy is a path that, whatever anyone thinks, I think most people could find themselves on had the cards fallen a little differently for them. So I try and avoid that.
But that I think, please wave your hands if you want to speak when I finish, though.
Sorry.
Because it's partly around that there is this enormous symbolism. We're writing about a symbol, not a reality.
Yeah.
And that, again, I suppose, is where you're comfortable in terms of what you're creating, a compelling image. I think somebody earlier mentioned, porridge. The two writers who wrote Porridge, I think, wrote something recently about how, you can create great drama and great humour out of positions where people cannot get out, where people are trapped, and prison is the archetype of that. So I think there's also something about the idea of prison representing in the inverse some of our ideas about freedom. But I'm going to stop there. I think the lady at the back there has something.
Actually, tell us who you are as well. That would be really helpful. Tell us who you are before you speak.
Katie's. I would probably put myself more in the academic camp than the, certainly not as a writer's camp, but I'm more a practitioner, I suppose. I've worked in the prison system in the UK and also in the US. So I'm really interested in what you said about the needing to be able to sell things to the American market, and having seen the reality of the criminal justice system in the United States. I think one observation is that some of the systems that I worked in, there seems to be this shared feeling, both by prisoners and by staff, of needing to kind of hold on to the rhetoric around what it means, what imprisonment means in America. And so I spent some time with prisoners in the Los Angeles jail system, which is very kind of gang segregated, race segregated, and does have high levels of violence, where for the first kind of 3-4 days of interviews with people, everybody was sticking to the story that all the violence was related to the gang interactions. By day 4, we're kind of starting to unravel a bit more of what was happening. And actually, one of the things that was a problem is that people were drying their smelly socks on the airbags. And it's kind of this, but to be able to break that down and people to actually acknowledge the kind of messy, human mundaneness of what's actually happening, it doesn't suit the narrative of either the staff or the prisoners themselves. And I think I've seen that so much more in the American system than I have when I've worked here in the UK, that this kind of image of this hyper-masculine, violent environment, and that there in some ways it's perpetuated by the people that you would imagine don't want it to be perpetuated. It's just a really interesting tension.
And I think that does feed into drama. I mean, if you look at something like the Law and Order franchise, you know, it's fine if you've got, you know, a child rapist or something, for the cops to, you know, slam the suspect up against the wall and sort of, you know, beat him up and leave him a bit bloody and all the rest. Whereas, you know, one would hope that if you did that with a British cop, you know, you would be showing that this guy's a bit out of control and a bit too violent and that someone should slap him down for it. So it's, you know, I think American crime narratives are very much more punitive.
I just wanted to take issue with the idea that, sorry, I write crime as Natasha Cooper or N.J. Cooper, and I take issue with the idea that what crime novelists are doing is dramatising evil. There are some, I mean, you could say Thomas Harris with his serial killer novels is doing that kind of thing, but I think an awful lot of us are driven by wanting to understand exactly what Adam says. We've all said in frivolous ways, I could have killed him, but hardly any of us do. And the interest of a lot of us is what exactly is it that tips someone across that line? And also, exactly what happens later? And a lot of us have written novels about what happens when someone comes out of prison after a very long sentence. I think there's been a certain misunderstanding among the academic side here of what a lot of crime writers are doing, why they're doing it, and what their novels are like. I just speak for the writers.
Okay, yeah, I'll just reply. I mean, yes, I think there are so many, it's a very diverse field. I'm not a great reader of crime fiction. I read something by Dennis Lehane and it scared the shit out of me. I didn't want you to read any more.
As Sean said, do go for Don Winslow.
Okay. Someone hit Paul.
Isn't the truth of any complex organisation that there is no truth? And what you've got is, as it were, complex coexisting truths. And the role of a sociologist, a criminologist, or indeed a novelist, is to, as it were, take something of an Olympian view and see how they interact and create, as it were, structure and interaction out of that, but to kind of dwell on one particular portion of that complexity is simply it may be interesting and worthwhile, but it's also a distortion. You want to see, as it were, how the whole works together or doesn't work together. And the idea you plump for any one, I think, is not necessarily an enlightened one.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I've written 4 crime novels, and they are, you know, what I'm interested in doing with them is to actually interrogate the institution of the police, hugely inspired by Roger along the way, books and films. But it's an interrogation rather than a. You know, one can't actually arrive at a truth, but
I'd also say that in addition to that Daily Mailness of this debate being driven by othering and simplifying life by other things, I think we're fundamentally very lazy. It takes a lot to understand any field. I mean, you know, something like that's as complex as this, which is tackling themes of economics, social background, law enforcement, you know, I mean, it's just such a complex field. And the average person, you know, some writers, a lot of TV executives that don't have the patience or the desire to go into the sort of level of detail that's needed to paint a comprehensive picture. So it's a lot easier to just, you know, go with what you've seen before. And I was talking to Dan earlier, and he said that he's had, you know, commissioning execs say to him, "Oh, doctors don't talk like that." Well, I mean, you heard yourself. He was a doctor, so you know he knows how doctors talk. So I think fundamentally, you know, laziness and this desire to other the criminal is behind a lot of this sloppy narrative that we get in fiction and also in the press.
I would give one example. I think something that I think one would hope might break the crime genre, but a Netflix series called Mindhunter. Which is based on the books by the very first FBI profilers of serial killers. And I read those books pretty much when they first came out. And they do show serial killers as pretty sad characters who enjoy masturbating, basically. And that's what Mindhunter doesn't shrink from showing you on screen. And I just think it's the best counter narrative and the best research narrative about the glamorous serial killers that so many books and TV shows.
But even there, within the criminal justice community, within the effort. So, one thing that I will say about the US, it's very easy to get information. So, the FBI, for example, have a specific liaison office that will. They have a dedicated team to provide help to authors and filmmakers.
I was part of a student party. The only person who was allowed in because I didn't have an American passport. What's the FBI headquarters called?
Quantity.
Yeah, I wasn't allowed in.
No, interesting. Because I mean, I've been to FBI headquarters in New York. I've had assistance from their media relations team. They're very, very accessible, and they have a very interesting view of the Mindhunter thing. There's dispute now about the validity of the research. Because they say it was self-selecting, that the psychopaths who were outgoing and you know wanted to talk were the ones who got selected. So it skewed the whole basis of that research. But it was interesting, you know, coming back to the fact about accessibility and how do writers get in to talk to you know prison officers or prisoners or police officers. The Americans have a very they are quite despite. I mean, to be honest, I'd be quite ashamed of their system in terms of what the results it has, but they are quite open in terms of getting access and a willingness to sort of talk. And the FBI justify it by saying we would rather that there was an accurate portrayal of the FBI within the media than that people were just sitting at home making up their own, you know, version of it. So they see a media, they see a benefit in ensuring the authentic portrayal of the FBI.
Roger,
go ahead. I just wanted to pick up two points. One was the one about murders, and also about, I've been in LA County Jail, and what was striking to me about that was that there were 80 people in a room, right, in cots just spread out across, and you just try and think about how you're going to experience your own life in a group of 80 people. Most, by the way, let's be clear, 60% of people in prison have mental health problems, right? That's sort of average. I'm filming in Winchester right now. The Durham prison medical people said about 60% have that. So we're talking about the majority of people have mental health problems. And the murderers, most of them, have never had a parking ticket. Right? And that's very important, that these kind of set ideas about what a murderer looks like, serial killers, all of that. I mean, one of the most interesting things about serial killers is that everyone says, oh, he was such a nice and so, but these are the kinds of things that, at least the documentary world, are meat and drink. And I was just going to mention one name which hasn't come up yet, but I urge you all, if you haven't read his books, is Tony Parker. Yeah. Life After Life, interviews with the stories of 12 murderers, you know, five women. These are terrific, verbatim accounts by the people themselves. So there's no intermediary, there's no mediation. This is what it's really like.
And he was your external, wasn't he?
He was, yes.
Yeah. Oh, was he? Yes. Well, there you go. You can say more about it. I can't.
Somebody at the back there? Yep. Yourself, yep.
Yeah, I'm interested in this narrative of Overeem.
David, introduce yourself first.
Oh, sorry, I'm a researcher at UCL. I'm interested in this narrative of Overeem and this separation from this fiction account and these criminologists and the Daily Mail. I think what we see more of is that's an interesting part of this, is that criminologists can be complicit in some of their narratives. These CBS awful programs that we see criminologists going on, amplifying this evil and buying into that discourse that we see a lot of. I can name names, but I'm not going to name names. He almost acts as this integrity where we're representing this. But I think we need to take some responsibilities as criminologists. Then we represent people, then we buy into these narratives of people.
Yeah, I mean, I slightly balk at the switch across the Atlantic so quickly and easily, sort of, because I think the images that we have of prison, again, this was for me, I suppose, the kind of revelation of going to prison was just, you know, full of people, some of whom I knew, some of whom I didn't know, and it sense, you know, I was doing 3 months, a lot of other people doing short sentences, but what we end up talking about are these sort of exceptional figures, whereas I think most people in prison are doing relatively short terms for, you know, not to say they're minor offences, a lot of horrible stuff goes on, but these are the people who become these monster others, the criminals. And I think that's one of the strange things, it's, you know, the fixity of that label and the utility of this conception of the criminal, this categorisation. As you say, we're sitting, you know, you might be sitting next to a criminal. You're damn sure sitting next to someone who's broken the law, you know, in some way or other, you know. We're all full of virtues and other things, as it were. So I'm slightly wary of the way it creates this monstrous other. And the I suppose the other thing is you know, the sense of always talking about prison in relation to crime and criminals. I don't think that's actually what it's all about.
I just Jeff Hughes, from former Governor of Belmarsh. I was just going to say I have a lot of sympathy with people who say we want to get our stories right, and to do that, it would be nice to get accessibility to prisons. About 2 years ago, as a former governor of Belmarsh Prison, I was organising a study tour for some Ukrainian prison staff, because I had done a lot of work in Ukraine. So we had the Minister of Justice for Ukraine, about 3 prison governors from Ukraine, and some other senior officials. The study tour involved talking to the Chief Inspector of Prisons, no problem. Prison Reform Trust, no problem. Prisons Ombudsman, no problem. I couldn't get them into Belmarsh. As a former governor and with a Minister of Justice for another country, denied access to Belmarsh Prison. So I have sympathy with people. And as a result of that, in many cases, if you can't find out the facts, then people make it up. And when you make it up, it's invariably wrong. So I haven't got a complete answer to that, other than to talk to some practitioners.